I'm here in my living room, peering through my mini blinds at a man who's sawing off something under my neighbor's car. Yep, this guy is stealing catalytic converters. And if you report thieves like him, you could get a reward up to $25,000. Just submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. That's H-E-A-T. The Virginia State Police HEAT Program. Reported. Rewarded.
This is ContactTalkRadio.com, consciousness in action, and you are taking action into your consciousness by tuning into Contact Talk Radio.
And on TuneIn.com, Ping.fm, and Upsnap Mobile.
Contact Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Madeira Show, where he will discuss testosterone, optimization, and full body health for the high-performance modern man. Now, here's your host, Dr. Madeira.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Sam Madeira back on the Dr. Madeira Show, and welcome. And today we have Dr. Kate Balestrieri. Hi, Kate. How's it going today?
Hi, I'm well. How are you?
Doing well, staying warm here in Seattle. We have early winter weather. So.
Oh, yikes.
Yeah, and you're in Miami, so you're on the opposite end of the spectrum.
Yes, and I'm sorry to say it is gorgeous outside here today.
I am definitely envious, so enjoy for all of us here in the Pacific Northwest. So for those of you who are not familiar with Dr. Kate Balestrieri, she is a licensed psychologist, certified sex therapist, and a certified sex addiction therapist. She is the co-founder of the Triune Therapy Group and the co-host of the live YouTube show Behind Closed Doors with Dr. Kate and Lauren. Dr. Balestrieri is a fervent believer in destigmatizing issues around mental health and sexuality, helping people thrive fully into their emotional, relational, sexual, and overall potential. I'm curious, over the last year or so, what has been one of the main themes that you're seeing with clients that you feel comfortable and is appropriate to share with our audience today?
Yeah, well, people come to work with me for all different kinds of reasons, right? But most of what people seek me out to help them address are problems in their relationships, their primary romantic relationships, their dating life, or their sex lives. So I would say one of the common underlying themes that people really bring to the sessions, and they may or may not be aware that this is what's bringing them in, is really shame. You know, so many times people feel like they are broken, or they're not worthy, or there's something inherently flawed about them if they're struggling in any one of these areas of life. And so I think that concurrent to addressing the actual problem or issue that's bringing someone in the room is also this thread of shame that seems to be a pretty almost universal theme in the work that I do with patients, regardless of what sort of the topical issue is that they're bringing in.
Yeah, that is really interesting that a lot of people, I mean, obviously I'm a hormone health specialist, so I work more in the physiological endocrine level mm-hmm. and balancing hormones. And oftentimes men and or women will come in and they'll be on antidepressants and for men, maybe Viagra, or have tried Viagra, or they're, you know, illegally taking, you know, their friend's mm-hmm. antidepressant medication and wanting to figure out the root cause of what's going on around anxiety, which I actually see more anxiety today than depression. Well, I would say both of them are kind of ubiquitous epidemics, but
yes,
anxiety seems to be kind of the front runner, where I think 20 years ago it may have been about a tie or flipped. So
well, you bring up such a great point. And so frequently I see people have both anxiety and depression. One may be more predominant in their presentation and their day-to-day experience. But especially with men, I see a lot of anxiety come out as irritability. And also a lot of depression come out as irritability. And so when we see that, it's really a good indicator to think about whether or not anxiety or depression or both may be an underlying treatment need.
Yeah, I'm curious. Let's back up just a little bit, maybe for our listeners who mm-hmm. maybe aren't familiar with the nature of sex therapy and psychology and working with a sex therapist and a therapist of your specialty. How mm-hmm. is a sex therapist different than if, let's say, I were to refer a couple, a married couple to a couples therapist? How would that be different?
It's a great question. So a sex therapist has had specific enhanced trainings around human sexuality, in addition to all of the same criteria that other therapists go through in terms of getting their licensure to practice as sort of generalists. And someone who carries the name of certified sex therapist has gone through so much more additional training to help themselves understand their own biases, because we all have biases, even though, you know, and I'm not saying we all as in therapists, I mean we all as in humans
right.
have biases. And so it's really important when we're working with sexuality and psychology to understand what biases are being brought to the table so you can keep them in check and stay more neutral and objective, because sexuality is a really nuanced conversation and everyone brings to the table different concerns, different strengths, different fears, different hopes, and different attachments to sexuality based on how they grew up. And a sex therapist has taken great measures to understand those nuances and really helps people work with levels of depth that other therapists may not be able to go into with them.
Excellent. And what is a sex therapist not, or what are maybe some myths or misinformation that you would like to dispel that you may have read online or heard people say, or maybe had to dispel for new clients that you've worked with?
I think one of the biggest misconceptions about sex therapy is that it's, I think people confuse sex therapists with sexual surrogacy sometimes, and there's an a hope or a fear that there might be contact between a sex therapist and a patient, and there is not. So that is something that comes up quite regularly.
Right.
Some people tend to think that a sex therapist is kind of an in-the-room coach, if you will, and sometimes I'll get messages from people who want me to watch videos of them and their partners being intimate and give them play-by-play feedback on how they could be better together in bed. Or sometimes people will try and send me pictures to ask about something they see on their body. And is it normal? Is it adequate? Things like that. So sex therapists don't really do those kinds of things. But what we do is check in with people around their own emotional processing about what they're seeing in the mirror. You know, I don't have to see your body parts to help you work through how you feel about them.
Right. Yeah. And the inadequacy and I think, you know, social media I'd like to get into porn addiction here in a little mm-hmm. bit with you, but even, you know, porn, I think can really play into men and women's kind of insecurities or mm-hmm. fears or inadequacies about their bodies. And
absolutely,
you know, unfortunately, you know, there's so much out there on social media alone. And, you know, before it was magazines, you know, and now there's just so much more for people to kind of compare themselves to and kind of have that negative mm-hmm. self-talk, if you will. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, we don't have a ton of time, and there's a lot of questions that I gathered from colleagues, and I have a men's only Facebook group called Live Strong. And if the listeners aren't in that group, you can check it out. It's free. There's no membership dues or anything, but it is men only. So men can feel more safe about sharing or talking or asking questions about certain things.
One, I love that.
Yeah, it's great. I started it about a year ago, November 2018. So we're almost at November 2019 now, and over 400 members. So
wow.
Strong, yeah. And they're from all over the world. And so it's been fantastic. lots of research. The focus is men's hormones, but you know, how to optimize your hormones with lifestyle, diet, nutrition, herbal medicine, testosterone, hormone, bioidentical hormone replacement therapies, optimization, et cetera. So it's definitely been monumental. And I've had men private message me and say, you know, even though I've been a fly on the wall, your group has changed my life. And, you know, I'm doing these things now and had all these improvements. So it's good to be able to give back in that way to the community of men. And, you know, there's a lot of kind of isolation and I think silent loneliness and silent depression and anxiety with men today, where, you know, they're trying to appear strong and successful and outwardly fine to everybody around them and kind of like hold their ground. So, you know, out of survival, really. And I think women have their kind of own version of that too. And we can probably speak to this more. But yes. it definitely can lead to, you know, more serious tragedies like suicide or drug and alcohol addiction, et cetera. One question that has come up over and over again in that group or from people, men in that group, is there's the NoFap movement, which is about not masturbating, no ejaculation, and no porn. And I'm just curious, from a sex therapist point of view, what are your thoughts on this? There's an article on Psychology Today that people can Google and read that a male psychologist wrote that I actually think was pretty well written. But I'm curious to get your input and what you've seen with clients who maybe are on one stream or another of this, where either they're a porn consumer addict or they're, you know, part of this NoFap movement.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting movement. And I think there are a lot of different reasons why men are joining this movement. And it's really up to them to assess, is this something that is healthy for me? Is it a form of deprivation? How would I know in either scenario? And much of what I talk with people about in sessions and in conversations like these are really understanding what's compelling you forward into this kind of movement. And many men who I've worked with who are in recovery from porn addiction have gravitated toward this movement because it gives them a sense of empowerment. And the ideology is pretty diverse within the group and within the movement, from my understanding. And I think that for some people, it's really containing. And it gives them a sense of community, and it gives them a sense of strength that they're not alone in their struggles to, you know, kind of maintain composure over an area in their lives where they may have felt really spun out or dysregulated. So I think from that regard, it can be a really helpful community for people. On the other hand, when somebody is being overly abstaining without reason, so for example, if they're not in recovery from a kind of porn addiction, or if they aren't trying to channel that energy into something they feel is more productive. I've seen people enter into the NoFap community because they have more of a self-depriving or masochistic unconscious compulsion. Now, it's really for them to decide if that's okay. For some people, that is a big part of what turns them on, and also what gives them a sense of grounding and meaning to engage in masochistic or depriving behavior. So, I mean, I think it's really only a problem if it's impacting someone's life in a negative way. Mm-hmm. So questions that I think are important to ask oneself would be, am I comfortable disclosing that I'm a part of this community to my partner, if they have a partner? If I'm not, why? What shame am I sitting on, or what fears am I sitting on that are, you know, precluding my ability to be open and honest about what I need or what gets me going in this area?
Interesting. Yeah. On the urology side of things, you know, looking at prostate health and the two leading cancers that are causing death in men today still are skin cancer and then prostate cancers. Mm-hmm. And there's some evidence showing, and even Harvard Medical School and journals have kind of like put this out as well, that we've seen frequent ejaculation be correlated with less likelihood of having prostate cancer in men. Mm-hmm. And then in Chinese medicine, I'm not a Chinese medicine practitioner or an acupuncturist, but I have colleagues that are, and they talk a lot about, you know, not kind of overdoing it to keep your chi or your life force energy strong, mm-hmm. and, you know, not depleting your body. And we know that if there's frequent ejaculation, you know, we're talking about daily or every other day or something like that, then you're going to be depleted in nutrients such as zinc, et cetera. So zinc helps you make testosterone and it's good for your immune system, hair, skin, nails, et cetera. The other thing that specifically that I've read in the research is that they're seeing up to 21 times a month ejaculation for men is the kind of preventative stance for prostate cancer, which is quite a bit. So, which is a sharp contrast to this NoFap movement, mm-hmm. you know, so coming from not necessarily a place of addiction, but a place of optimal health and preventative medicine, preventative lifestyle medicine. That's kind of what I found in the research. So I was curious from a sex therapist point of view, mm-hmm. How that, you know, what the cross-section was. With porn addiction, how do you define mm-hmm. porn addiction, and when does it become, you know, just kind of a, you know, I'm just going to see if I can have some more visual stimulation or mm-hmm. curiosity to actual defined diagnosed addiction?
Right. Well, a couple of things. So one, there is no diagnosis for porn addiction or sex addiction in the current diagnostic and statistical manual for mental health, or the DSM, as we call mm-hmm. it, shorthand.
Right.
But there is a category for impulse control disorder. And I tend to think about porn addiction as just that, right? This is somebody who is struggling to contain their impulses around this area of behavior. So when I'm thinking about what's the benchmark or the threshold between porn being something that can be constructive in someone's life and then moving in toward more of an addictive or compulsive state, is I would look at the criteria for addiction in general. And
I'm here in my living room peering through my mini blinds at a man who's sawing off something under my neighbor's car. Yep, this guy is stealing catalytic converters. And if you report thieves like him, you could get a reward up to $25,000. Just submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. That's H-E-A-T. The Virginia State Police HEAT Program. Reported. Rewarded.
Michael J. for Hope for the Warriors. Started back in 06 at Camp Lejeune. Military families witnessing the effects of war on their loved ones. Now, almost 20 years later, they've aided over 53,000 service members, veterans, and families with confidential, high-quality behavioral health care services at little or no cost to post-9/11 vets and their families. Over 91% of every dollar donated goes directly to the programs. If you're as concerned about our heroes as I am, go to hopeforthewarriors.org.
And ask myself things like, okay, are there any negative ramifications in my life because of my watching porn? So that can be anything from physical health to the relational health of their primary partnerships, or maybe being more isolated and so not having enough opportunities to go out and have relationships in real life. It can also be things like medical complications that can happen with excessive masturbation. There are several people who have gone down the road of, you know, injuring themselves, and that can be wildly problematic. So we look at things like, what are the negative consequences, if any, in someone's life, and are they continuing to watch porn and masturbate despite those consequences? And if so, have they tried to stop and been unable to stop? And if those things all exist, then I might say, is there any evidence of tolerance? And in this case, it would be, tolerance would look like needing more and more intensity in the visual stimuli that you're seeing, or more frequency, or longer durations of time with porn and masturbation. So anything that you need more and more or bigger and more intense to achieve the same level of pleasure would be an indication of tolerance. And then lastly, I would look at withdrawal. And so when someone tries to stop, do they experience an uptick in anxiety, depression, shifts in their appetite or their ability to sleep? Are they feeling any kind of physiological upset in addition to those things? You know, some people will break out or they get more anxious and more nervous. They start getting more irritable in other areas of life. So, I mean, the post-acute withdrawals are pretty real, and most people discount them because we don't think about things that don't involve substances or addictions that don't involve substances to carry real acute withdrawal symptoms, but in fact, behavioral addictions do. So I would look at all of those things, and if someone says, oh yeah, that applies, yep, I feel that, then we might start talking about, is this a compulsive or addictive behavior that you might want to get some containment around?
Yeah, thanks for that definition. I've seen some kind of controversial posts on Instagram specifically by other sex therapists who are saying mm-hmm. porn addiction isn't a real addiction and there's no such thing as sex addiction rather. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I guess porn addiction as well. And what I've seen clinically on the men's health side of things is men who are able to achieve erection and masturbate during, you know, watching porn, but are not able to with their partner or partners. Mm-hmm. And it's devastating, and or premature ejaculation becoming mm-hmm. a real problem for them with their mm-hmm. significant other, but not a problem while they're watching pornography. So yeah. Also for the listeners, you know, pornography, a lot of pornography is staged, and mm-hmm. you know, they're using, for the men specifically, they're using different medications or combinations of medications so that the men will be able to maintain an erection for hours during the shoot. And you know, those are medications that I have prescribed to men, not all at once, but for erectile dysfunction and things like that. But they're, you know, they're, it's not quote unquote real sex per se. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, what we're seeing is like you see in the movies, a regular film, a staged, you know, lighting, there's changes made to the actors and things like that, mm-hmm. As well as the, you know, medications to help them kind of last longer and things like that to get the shoot. Yeah. So
there's really nothing authentic about what we see in mainstream porn, you know, commercialized porn. It's such a fantasy world, and that's part of why it's so appealing. I really appreciate what you're saying, because it's not reality and it's not sustainable. So a lot of people come to see me because they're comparing themselves, men and women, to what they're seeing in porn and judging themselves for not being able to last as long sexually or, you know, achieve the same kinds of pleasure that they see people experiencing in porn. And real life and real sex just aren't like that. You know, it's messy and it's awkward sometimes. And, you know, you hear sounds and noises that don't come through in the porn videos. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's easier to laugh and be humble when you're being real, but that doesn't come through. They didn't show a lot of playfulness in porn.
It's true. Yeah. And with that, are you seeing people with porn addiction have other kind of co-addictions where maybe they're addicted to nicotine or they're addicted to alcohol or medications or drugs or anything like that?
There's a pretty high co-occurrence of addiction interactions and co-occurring addictions for people who struggle with any kind of behavioral addiction or substance addiction. And what we see typically is that when someone starts to get containment or control over one addiction and get into recovery, if they're not addressing the underlying issues, that addiction usually, like whack-a-mole, pops up in some other iteration of their life. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it can get a little confusing because people will think, wow, I'm recovered from this, but why don't I feel any better or different? And then if we take a step back and take a macro look at their lives, we can see that the same addictive messiness has just transferred to a different area. So sometimes that looks like nicotine. Sometimes it looks like raging. Sometimes it looks like exercise. Sometimes it looks like alcohol. Sometimes it looks like getting into compulsive relationships and, you know, kind of diving in a little too fast or too deep.
Okay. Yeah, that's good to have that awareness for everybody. And with, are you seeing a lot of gaming addiction? You're in Miami or LA or both?
Great question. Soon to be both. My office currently is in Los Angeles, but I am licensed in Florida and working on setting up an adjacent office here.
So, excellent.
Yeah, lots of good stuff happening.
Congratulations.
But yes, thank you. To answer your question, yes, I'm definitely seeing a lot of gaming addictions and social media addictions. I mean, anybody who has a smartphone, I think would wager to weigh in on this, but they have become such a source of lifeblood for most people. And mm-hmm. if you look at your screen time for real, most people are shocked by how much time they're on their phones. But we are connected and tethered to them, and it's changing the way our bodies regulate.
Yeah, there's actually quite a bit of research showing blue light from screens, smartphones, and computers are altering people's ability to make melatonin, leading to insomnia, and then altering specifically women's hormones, but men's hormones too, ability to make reproductive or sex hormones. So, you know, testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're talking about sexual health for men and women and you're on your phone all the time or your computer and then your phone after work, maybe look at that. How would you define social media addiction? Are we talking about all the kind of same criteria and questions mm-hmm. for sex addiction and porn addiction?
Yeah, I would look at the same criteria. How much time are you spending on it? Is that more time than you'd like to be spending on it for any reason? Are you looking at things that go against your own value system? Is your screen time impacting your ability to function in life in other ways? You know, did you forget to feed your dog today, but found time to stay on Instagram for 2 hours looking at whatever you're looking at, you know, things like that. And if you can utilize social media or video games or porn or exercise or any of the things, right, because we can get addicted to anything. If you can utilize those things in moderation and you don't have problems putting it down and having a full life, then I would say go forth and do it. But for some people, it can become automatic and compulsive and we don't even realize it, kind of like a frog in boiling water.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. Yeah, I've definitely tried to put timers on things myself to kind of remind myself, okay, this is enough time on social media today. I think the rub comes in for maybe people who, like myself, are running their own business, and then the expectations are very high today to stay active mm-hmm. and engaging your audience on social media and mm-hmm. potentially eventually getting new clients or growing your business that way. And mm-hmm. that wasn't the case, you know, in 2010. So
right,
it's a different world today, as you're mentioning. With go ahead.
I was just going to say, there are a lot of new apps out there that are helping small business owners really accomplish that balance and combat exactly what you're saying, because the market does demand for business owners who want to use social media to be far more engaged, and that in and of itself can be a full-time job. So there are a lot of scheduling apps that help people be more proactive and intentional so they can be more moderate in their screen time throughout the week.
That's great. Are you talking about stuff like Hootsuite and stuff like mm-hmm. that? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a good point. Back to kind of sexual dysfunction or mm-hmm. maybe a segue from sex addiction and porn addiction is premature ejaculation seems to be pretty common mm-hmm. and not easy for men and their significant other to kind of cope with, as well as potentially in some cases challenging to get treatment resolution. I'm curious mm-hmm. how you address that for men in therapy. I mean, I know this, we could talk about this probably for an hour and a half, but maybe a synopsis.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there are some themes, even though every man has a different relationship to this issue. In fact, it's an issue for him. So again, shame is a huge component here. And when we're talking about anything in our bodies that doesn't work the way we want it to work, in this case, the ejaculation is happening faster than someone wants it to. So we're looking at a breakdown of a lot of different things to address clinically. We're looking at the reaction that men have to their bodies and whether or not they're feeling betrayed by their bodies, because you know, their body is totally circumventing the rules, right? And and playing by its own set. And that can be really frustrating and engender some powerlessness and feelings of helplessness in men. And that can make them feel really discouraged to try and find solutions. So I think, you know, we address the shame, we address the feelings that come up as a reaction to this issue when it arises. And then secondarily, we talk about different strategies that men can use to actually start to course correct. And a lot of those strategies include, you know, changing the way their body experiences sensation and learning how to become more aware of the physiological cues to an ejaculation sooner so they can intervene in a way that doesn't feel completely obstructive of the sexual experience, right? And I work with a lot of couples to help the partners get involved so it can be fun and it can be collaborative and it can be intimacy building instead of isolation building, which often happens before people get into treatment.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot more healing than, you know, the shaming. And I've definitely worked with men who feel ashamed or less than because of premature ejaculation. And I mean, maybe we can define what premature ejaculation is, because, you know, if somebody thinks that they should last a certain amount of time, maybe that is unreasonable or kind of great expectations that don't need to be put on them.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't have a definitive answer for you because I think so much of it is subjective. Mm-hmm. But I do think that a lot of the men that I work with will report ejaculating within the first few minutes of any kind of sexual activity. And for them, that feels frustrating. Sometimes it's frustrating also for their partners because, you know, they have to kind of anticipate that their playtime might be shorter than they would both like. So, I think it's important to build a lot of other foreplay into those kinds of situations so that people can really experience pleasure that isn't focused so much on whether or not there is an orgasm and how quickly it arises.
Yeah, it's good to have that awareness. And are you seeing a lot of men who already have anxiety and maybe, you know, whether it's work anxiety or situational anxiety play into the premature ejaculation? Or is it pretty isolated most of the time?
You mean the issue of premature ejaculation, is that isolated and that's the only issue someone's struggling with? Or is it often accompanied with anxiety about other things? Is that your question?
Yes, yes.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think when somebody's body isn't working the way they would like for it to be working, it can tend to become a predominating and preoccupying thought in their minds. And this has been something that many of my male patients have disclosed, you know, feeling like they can't get this part of their life to be on track. And so that corrupts their ability to exercise confidence at work, exercise confidence as a parent. I mean, it undermines their sense of self sometimes. And that can feel really challenging for people. So it does start to create anxiety, and anxiety from other parts of their world might then further exacerbate any kind of anxieties in the bedroom.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And with, in general, I'm curious, kind of off topic from the premature ejaculation, but I'm aware of certain antidepressant medications that are causing issues with libido for men. And I'm curious if you're seeing this show up a lot with your clients over the years where they're on different SSRIs and that's, you know, decreased their libido and they have zero interest in sex.
Yes, I see that with both male and female patients. And I'm not a psychiatrist, so I can't really speak to the medication aspect of it. It's outside right. my scope of practice, mm-hmm. but it absolutely is something that a lot of patients report. And it is so prevalent, you know, for people who are taking those medications to make reports of that being a frustrating side effect, that I've recently begun exploring other innovative options to help people treat anxiety and depression and post-traumatic stress and other things that they might be taking SSRIs or anxiolytics for. And an interesting and innovative technology that is out there is actually the use of ketamine to treat some of these underlying psychological issues. And ketamine does not seem to have the same kind of side effects that patients are reporting for SSRIs.
Excellent. Yeah, I actually have.
I'm here in my living room, peering through my mini blinds at a man who's sawing off something under my neighbor's car. Yep, this guy is stealing catalytic converters. And if you report thieves like him, you could get a reward up to $25,000. Just submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. That's H-E-A-T. The Virginia State Police HEAT Program. Report it. Rewarded.
Michael J. for Hope for the Warriors. Started back in 06 at Camp Lejeune. Military families witnessing the effects of war on their loved ones. Now, almost 20 years later, they've aided over 53,000 service members, veterans, and families with confidential, high-quality behavioral health care services at little or no cost to post 9/11 vets and their families. Over 91% of every dollar donated goes directly to the programs. If you're as concerned about our heroes as I am, go to hopeforthewarriors.org.
A colleague here in North Bend, Washington, about 45 minutes east of downtown Seattle, where my clinic is, and they have a medical doctor in their practice doing IV ketamine for chronic mm-hmm. pain, chronic depression, like that intractable mood disorder with depression that is untreatable with a lot of other conventional and natural treatments. So,
yeah.
Can be revolutionary for people.
Can be.
Yeah, it's exciting that that's now available or becoming more available to the general public as an option.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I remember in the late 90s, I think it was like a street drug that, you know, people would talk about ketamine or Special K. So it's, you know, obviously these things started as pharmaceuticals. So it's good to keep them in the clinical realm and
Absolutely.
Less as a street medication. So for men, one thing that comes to mind for me is that, you know, I've worked with probably at this point thousands of men over the years, and a lot of men are maybe skeptical of therapy or couples therapy or sex therapy, or they may feel like talk therapy won't work for them, et cetera. They, you know, they have their kind of ambivalence or reservations about seeking this out. How do you help men realize there's more than just physiological or medical reasons for sexual dysfunctions in your time working for them?
That's a really good question. And it's so unfortunate that men are socialized away from so many of their emotions and so many of their relational opportunities, because it might conflict with, you know, their construction of masculinity. And so I often will work with men to try to understand, even if they are not buying into therapy, if their partner is, can that help the relationship? Can it help their sex life? And can they see therapy as a tool to help strengthen the relationship that they have with their partner, if they're coming in as part of a coupleship, for example? And, you know, can they look at it as something that is helping their partner, and can they go along with it in that way? And then, you know, sometimes, in fact, more often than not, I would say a lot of men appreciate that, because even though they might feel like, well, I don't need therapy, or this is too emotional, or this is kind of too hippy-dippy whale music-y for me, it's not my jam, then, you know, that's great. But if it's working for your partner and that's helping your relationship, does it behoove you to participate? And, you know, a lot of guys will say, yeah, it does. And then in 6 months or even 3 months, they might be like, yeah, I'm actually getting something out of this too. if they keep an open enough mind. You know, if someone's really resistant and really feels like I shouldn't be here and this isn't for me, I would encourage them to talk with their partner and the therapist about why they feel that way. And are there other things that they might brainstorm so that, you know, they can feel like they're getting something out of it?
Yeah, I like that, keeping an open mind and, you know, testing it out. If you're such a scientist, you know, give it a chance to work before you throw in the towel, you know, like you're saying, 3 to 6 months. What is the frequency you would typically recommend for a new, let's say a couple is seeing you and they come in for the first visit, and let's kind of create maybe a more kind of detailed hypothetical situation. Maybe there's some low libido with one of the couples, maybe a mix kind of erectile dysfunction, premature ejaculation picture with the male, and maybe the female is having low libido and ambivalence about, okay, well, the performance hasn't been where we want it to be, so what's the point, or why are we doing this? So in that situation, what would be your kind of prescribed frequency and duration for therapy from your experience?
Yeah, great question. The way that I work with couples is the first several sessions that we have are really geared toward conducting a thorough assessment of each of them as individuals, and then together in their coupleship, who are they? What's the personality of their coupleship? And, you know, I do this just through talking with them about who they are, how they met, how they came to be struggling with the things they struggle with, what are their strengths. And, you know, together very collaboratively, we talk about what are the next steps. And that includes a conversation about what has come out of the initial assessment conversation. And then also, what are their goals for therapy? And then we decide on a frequency of working together that feels like they can sustain. And so for many couples, I see them once a week. For other couples who either come to LA or in Miami where I can do some concierge work, we'll set up what we call like a mini intensive. And they'll come and work with me for a whole day. And we'll do specific exercises around communication, around boundaries, around shame reduction, and around like really increasing the amount of intimacy potential that they have emotionally, physically, and sexually. So we can get really creative and work with whatever the couple's stated goals are, their resources are, and how quickly they want to move forward. You know, some couples want to go 100 miles an hour into treatment, and other couples, you know, feel like, you know, half a mile an hour is more their pace. And so it's really up to all of us to have that conversation, because if somebody is being dragged into therapy or they're really nervous about what it's going to look like, it's important to honor that pace and not push people too fast. So that's really key.
Yeah, I like that approach, you know, meeting them where they're at, not rocking the boat too hard. Yeah. How would you approach if, you know, let's say I referred you a married couple or a couple that was, you know, long-term monogamous relationship, if one of those partners felt like they were being quote unquote dragged into therapy, and the other one, let's kind of flip the script, and let's say the male is really ready to go and motivated about this, and then the female is kind of ambivalent, the wife or the girlfriend is ambivalent about, okay, well, I don't really have a lot of time for this. How much is this going to cost, or whatever the main objections people usually say in this situation? How do you work with a couple in that situation where maybe one person isn't as motivated to go forward and the other person is ready to go 100 miles per hour, as you were saying?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it happens all the time, right? Because when we are tasked with the potential for change, sometimes people are really excited about that, and sometimes it brings up lots of self-protection mechanisms. So if I'm working with a couple where their pace is very different for change, a lot of what we are doing is trying to get them on the same pace, or at least a closer pace together, so that they can work together, because this is about their coupleship, it's about their relationship. And I don't have an allegiance to either partner. My therapeutic relationship is to the coupleship. And so I'm also a PACT trained therapist, which is the psychobiological approach to couples therapy. And what I love about this style of couples work is that the focus is off the therapist as a third in the room, right? And really is geared toward helping the couple become experts on each other in the moment. So what I'm doing with couples as I work with them is helping them have the conversation about, well, why are you resistant to this? You know, what does it mean to you? And, but we can't afford it, right? Like, well, you know, help me understand where the hesitance is. And then we really unpack, well, what does it mean if we jump into this and we either do find some resolution or we don't find resolution? And, you know, help couples have the conversation together and guide them to pay attention to the different micro expressions that their partner is signaling, because we give off so much great information in our nonverbal communication. But partners often, when they get stressed, they kind of silo into their own world and we stop paying attention to each other. And so we get self-protective. And so my work with couples is about helping them break down those defenses so they can come back together and realize that it's the two of them against the problem, as opposed to the two of them against each other.
Wonderful. Yeah, that's seems like a lot more successful approach there than them trying to fight each other around a problem.
Yeah. But, switching, you know, we're all humans.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, recognizing our humanness, and I think forgiveness is a big thing. A lot of us have to relearn or learn deeper in the, in these relationships.
Self-forgiveness and forgiveness of our partner.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And do you work with couples remotely from LA?
Couples work can be a little tricky to do online. I will work with them and do some basic workshop or psychoeducational kinds of things, or we can do, you know, type of assessments online, and then I can provide them with resources. But I prefer to do couples work in person because of the modality that I use. It is much easier for me to work with people when I'm in the room and I can feel their energy in the room. I can see their full body picture of what's happening nonverbally. And some of that gets truncated when you try to work remotely. But I do provide concierge services in the states that I'm licensed. So of course, California, Florida, Illinois, and then people, like I said, come out and do intensives. So we can do some prep work leading up to that and debriefing from that remotely as well.
Excellent. Good to know. I know we're almost out of time, but I kind of have a bigger topic to open up, and we can maybe just touch on it a little bit here. So something that I've seen in the communities on the West Coast and friends and whatnot, and just kind of talking to people more and more, is this kind of bigger topic of polyamory or open relationships. Mm-hmm. And there's the book, I think it's called The Ethical Slut. And then I think there's another book called Opening Up, which is, I think, written by psychologists. But I'm curious, you know, there's, I guess, within that, this debate, are we inherently biologically and psychologically meant to be monogamous or serial monogamous, one partner for life or multiple partners, but monogamous, or is this a constitutional personality thing where some people are just more naturally able and attracted to polyamory in real life? Or what's, you know, what are you kind of seeing, and what is what the things that you've seen with clients or in your community at large that is kind of giving you a pulse on this? With relationship? Well,
great question. There is a growing movement toward destigmatizing ethical non-monogamy. And I think that the answer to your question is that I think we are both hardwired for connection and security in our relationships. And we're also hardwired to reproduce and repopulate the next generations. And unfortunately, sometimes those things are in competition with each other. So we have to look at things like mating strategies, right? Men's bodies are created in a way that they can impregnate many women concurrently. So from a biological and evolutionary standpoint, sometimes that can result in a low paternal investment in whatever offspring might be created. Now then our humanness, our relationalness kicks in and says, well, hang on, you know, kids really thrive when they have lots of people involved in their lives. And so there are adaptations and evolutions that created more of a pair bonding dynamic. And so I don't think that biologically, because men and women's bodies are different, doesn't mean that we're not hardwired for monogamy, but it also doesn't mean that we are, right? There's just no easy answer for this. We have really sophisticated, gorgeous brains that are also still very primitive at the same time. And so we have some competing stuff. And I think what's important to look at is if you and or any of the partners that you choose to be in relationship with are on the same page, you're communicating, you're open, you're transparent, you're debriefing regularly. I've seen ethical non-monogamy work really well for some people. And then for other people, it just doesn't. And so there's no one right way to be relational and there's no one right way to be sexual. So I would say if you're curious about it, talk with your partner, explore the pros and cons, and then talk about the belief systems that you both have that might create, you know, little pockets of shame or conflict as you explore what opening up the dynamic might look like. But there are a lot of really robust ethical non-monogamous communities in the West Coast. I mean, San Francisco has a thriving community. Los Angeles has a really active community. So there's lots of places, you know, I don't know what Seattle's community is like. Maybe you can speak to that. But I tend to see a lot of open-mindedness in some of the more metropolitan areas.
Definitely. Yeah, I'm not aware of the community here. I just have known friends who were kind of, that was their mindset. And mm-hmm. I do see it more accepted or explored and accepted in the homosexual community in Seattle and San Francisco. And I think that spills over into, you know, the people that are not homosexual that are, okay, I'm open to this too. Mm-hmm. With your work with couples as a sex therapist over the years, or, you know, just one-on-one clients, how much of this shame is coming from traumas in childhood or traumas, you know, from their parents or first caretakers or later on in life, whether it, you know, is a sexual trauma or not? How much of that shame is coming from those experiences, whether they're unconscious or conscious, and how's mm-hmm. that showing up for them?
So I think it's important to consider a few things, right? We have our own set point and temperament when we're born that may or may not create a valence to be more shame-bound. And then we have the experiences of learning, social learning, and observing the way other people manage their feelings that influences how we then relate to our own emotions. And then we have the variable of experiences that we have in life.
I'm here in my living room, peering through my mini blinds at a man who's sawing off something under my neighbor's car. Yep, this guy is stealing catalytic converters. And if you report thieves like him, you could get a reward up to $25,000. Just submit a confidential tip at heatreward.com or call 1-800-947-HEAT. That's H-E-A-T. The Virginia State Police HEAT Program. Reported. Rewarded.
Shapes our emotional tapestry. And then we also have all of the influences from our peer groups, from our cultural groups, from our religious groups, from the media, from what we see around us. And all of those things shape who we are, and they are inescapable. right? No matter what part of the world you live in, because we are relational creatures, we are influenced by all of the things that we see around us. So to answer your question, childhood trauma can play a huge role in the development of shame, but also in the development of resilience. And, you know, people are very quick to say if anyone has any kind of atypical sexual practices or fantasies that they must have had some sort of trauma. And there just aren't a lot of studies to prove that causal relationship necessarily, certainly a correlative relationship. But I think what we overlook as a culture is the influence of what we see on TV, what we see in social media, the role that porn has played in shaping a lot of people's shame and or their willingness to be open and explore. And there's just really no one way to be, because everyone is different given all of those predisposing set points that they're bringing to how they interpret all of the other data that they are exposed to on a daily basis. And so much of it is processed unconsciously and quickly, we don't even realize it until 5 years later, we're like, wow, why do I think the way I think about X, Y, Z? And if we really start to dismantle it, we can peel back a lot of layers, and that can be really freeing and liberating for people.
That's good to hear. Yeah, that does. And I really liked what you said about trauma creating resilience and giving it kind of that silver lining of this actually is going to make you stronger. You know, it's kind of like Friedrich Nietzsche, who I'm a fan of, and I studied him a lot actually in high school and wrote a pretty extensive research paper on him. You know, he's quoted to say a lot of things around, you know, I think people have kind of bastardized his quote, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But there's some truth to that, and having resilience to, you know, survive career changes, you know, growing and changing with your significant other, working out these kind of big issues that we're talking about that can potentially end relationships, like premature ejaculation or low libido. And I was just talking to a colleague yesterday, and they were saying, you know, one of my friends just divorced her husband because he had no libido for years. And one of the most shocking things that I realized is when I asked my patients who have erectile dysfunction, you know, when was the last time you were having, you know, firm erections that you could rely on every single time you were engaged in sexual activity or whatnot. And, it, you know, I've heard 2 to 13 years. So, no wonder marriages are not lasting, you know.
Yeah,
people are not pleased or able to engage in a healthy sex life. And it does seem like we're in an era of rewarding people by overworking, and then both couples are exhausted, and then if they have kids or not, then that adds another level of responsibility and work, if you will, around raising one or more children. And then there's not a lot of extra energy and or time for even kind of intimacy, whether it's just sitting on the couch holding hands or cuddling or sex. And it's kind of hard to like restoke that fire. I'm curious, real quick, you know, what are some ways that you've seen effective for couples to kind of reinvigorate the passion or the intimacy?
Great question. And you hit on something really important here. We are a chronically and compulsively busy culture. And one of the things that is so important is self-care. Now, self-care can mean different things to different people, but I think about self-care as a mandate, really, for our relational wellness and our individual wellness. And it's important to look at how do you take care of yourself from a time perspective? How do you take care of yourself from an intention perspective? How well can you say no to things so that you're not overextending and depleting yourself of energy? Because so much of what couples struggle with is having the zeal and the zest and the energy to even have these conversations. I've worked with couples who will orbit around in their avoidance for years, right? And they're too busy to go to couples therapy. They're too busy to sit down with each other and have a weekly or, you know, forget a nightly conversation about their day. And that's really key. You know, building that intimacy requires energy. And if you're not taking care of yourself, you don't have your own hobbies, if you're not, you know, making sure that you have diversity in the experiences of your day, you are far more likely to be susceptible to burnout, to untreated mental health issues like anxiety, depression, so on and so forth. And all of those things just take a toll on your sex life after a while in your relational life. So, you know, get a manicure, go on that golf trip, do the things that really, you know, allow you to decompress, recharge, and then bring something back to the table. That's it. Mm-hmm. We can't create something out of nothing. So you've got to bring bandwidth to the table. And the only way to do that is to make sure that you're replenishing your own.
Yeah, well said. I'm a big proponent of self-care and community building and, you know, doing healthy things with friends and or family or significant other that are healthy instead of, you know, Netflix and chill and let's eat all the things and binge eat on the couch and then collapse, you know?
That can be self-care sometimes too in moderation.
Yeah, in moderation, yeah. Maybe two shows instead of 10, yeah.
Yes, two shows, half the tub of ice cream and maybe one order of truffle fries per week.
Right, yeah.
But really, you know, I think about things like, are your finances in order? Are you taking time to be intentional with how you structure your spending so that you can breathe around that? So many people don't think about, have I seen a financial planner this year? And is that a way that I'm setting myself up for self-care versus, more reactivity and stress and worry? So it's things like that that really make a big impact, and people really underestimate the value of being proactive and being intentional with time, money, food, you know, other kinds of all things that impede our ability to live life or the things that we stress out about.
Yeah, well said. And I like that financial planner aspect because oftentimes it's kind of like a chicken or the egg thing or the dog chasing its tail. You know, can people afford things like optimizing their hormones with a doctor like me or working with a sex therapist like you? And they're, you know, working a lot, but they don't have the resources or they haven't created the resources to take care of themselves when things are starting to fall apart or before they fall apart. And then if they wait longer, it becomes much more expensive or much more painful. So, proactive, preventative approaches are usually more cost efficient, but also having those resources and those savings for that kind of rainy day, or, you know, we hopefully do that for when our car breaks down, but we're really not trained or conditioned to do that for our own health, mental and physical, emotional. So
that's right. And therapy or hormone treatment are usually much less expensive than divorce. So I would recommend that people, you know, really think about how do they want to prioritize the resources that they do have. I'm not saying that everyone needs to go into therapy or have hormone therapy, but certainly if that's part of the constellation of what could help, how do they want to reorganize themselves so that they are prioritizing what's important to them?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And divorce is painful. I mean, if maybe sometimes that is the best thing, but hopefully people can at least take the steps beforehand and, you know, getting a great qualified sex therapist like yourself and optimizing hormones. Because if you have low hormones, not only is your brain deteriorating and your bones, but other areas of your health, and that's going to affect your ability to maintain your career and really be successful there as well. So maybe the sex isn't motivating, but maybe being able to make more money can motivate some people here. But, everybody has different motivating factors.
That's right.
So do you have any recommendations? I'm going to mention your social media and your YouTube channel here in a second again for everybody.
Thank
but
you.
Are there any books or one book that you recommend around shame was kind of a big theme today around something that somebody could read or listen to on Audible that could help them kind of start to unravel shame that they're already experiencing today?
Yeah. There are a couple of books that I love for shame. Hold on. I'm just pulling up the proper titles to make sure that I get them right. Dr. Stephen Poulter wrote a really great book recently called The Shame Factor, Heal Your Deepest Fears and Set Yourself Free. I really like that book for shame reduction. But you know, for couples, or even not for couples, Stan Tatkin has a couple of really books that help address a lot of what is underlying conflict in relationships. So one of the books that I love from him is called Wired for Love. And I would recommend anyone pick that up, as well as We Do, which is an amazing book that looks at how couples can proactively set themselves up for having all these hard conversations in a way that really aligns them for success. You know, they build intentional social contracts between the two of them and really, you know, talk about all these different topics. And so he gives a great, like, step-by-step guide on how to do that. Yeah, there are a bunch of other books. People can check out my social media or my website, which is triunetherapy.com, for additional resources. There's a bunch of awesome books out there that can be helpful.
Great. Thank you so much for that. And everybody can find Dr. Kate on Instagram if you're on there at Dr. Kate. I'm going to spell your last name for the listeners. So okay. Dr. Kate, KateBalesteri. So that's the right. Instagram handle. And she's on Twitter at Kate Balesteri. And the YouTube channel, again, for everybody, you can check it out. It's great. I've watched a few of them already. Behind Closed Doors with Dr. Kate and Lauren, live on YouTube, Thursdays at 7:30. Is that Pacific Standard Time?
Yeah, I'm so glad you're mentioning that. We actually are not live anymore.
Okay.
For this season, we are going to go to some pre-recorded episodes. But yes, that's the correct channel. There's lots of good content there. And on our website, we have seasons 1 and 2 of Behind Closed Doors, where we were on the KABC radio station in Los Angeles, as well as direct to podcast episodes too. So there's lots of great content in all of those seasons. Definitely check it out. We talk about lots of different issues related to sexuality, mental health, relationships, addiction, and recovery. And it's awesome. It's a great resource.
Thanks for doing that. I know that's a lot of extra work. So thanks for offering that to the public, for everybody to help them. And then you're also on Facebook. So same handle as Instagram, Dr. Kate, BALESTRIERI. So yeah. Everybody follow Dr. Kate, and you can, you know, listen to her YouTube channel while you're driving to work, if you're a commuter, or, you know, when you're getting ready in the morning. We all have a lot more time than we think to kind of plug these things into our lives and get benefit out of them. And thank you so much for your time today. I know you're really busy. You're opening up another satellite practice in Miami. So I appreciate you offering your time to everybody today.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for the invitation. This is great. This is a big part of why I do what I do, right? Because lots of people have questions, and the more people like you and I out there having conversations like this, the more we can reduce the stigma around having these conversations, and, you know, people can go about, you know, getting the help that they want and need, and then having the lives that they really are able to live fully.
Yeah. I mean, I love that. And, you know, giving them the container like you give them. So it's excellent. Yeah. The work that you're offering people. And I know this was very informative for a lot of people, and I'm sure new approaches for some out there as well. So everybody, please share the podcast with friends and family. This is an ad-free podcast, and I'm keeping it that way. So the more you share with, the more that we can keep going here. And we will see you next time on the next show. Now, here's for my mandatory disclaimer. This is a medical information podcast and is only for general information purposes. It does not substitute or constitute the practice of medicine or any medical practices, including the giving of medical advice to any individual.
And please observe that no doctor-patient relationship has been formed here. This medical podcast offers health, hormone, fitness, and nutrition information and is designed for educational purposes only. You should not rely on this information as a substitution for, nor does it replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have any concerns or questions about your health, you should always consult with a physician or other healthcare professional. Do not disregard, avoid, or delay obtaining medical or health-related advice and appropriate treatment from your healthcare professional. Users should seek the care of their physician or healthcare professional for any such conditions. The use of any information provided on this podcast is solely at your own risk. The contents and topics of this podcast have not been evaluated by the FDA nor approved by any other government or official body. The topics and content covered is not intended to diagnose, cure, or prevent any disease or disorder of any kind. Developments in medical research may impact the health, fitness, and nutritional advice that appears here on the podcast in the future episodes. No assurance can be given that the advice contained in this podcast will always include the most recent findings or developments in medicine with respect to the particular material covered. If you are in the United States and think you are having a medical or health emergency, call your healthcare professional or 911 immediately. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to hearing your feedback and looking forward to have you on future podcasts. Thank you.